Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
Hello out there.
Hey guys.
This is Amanda Dell.
This is Kimberly Chow.
And you're listening to Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair on Heritage Radio Network. Food Book Fair is an annual food media festival held here in New York and maybe coming to a city near you in the future. And we are your hosts of Recommended Reading, where we get to chat with some of our favorite friends and fam and collaborators about what they're reading, watching, and listening to, and what they're up to.
We are super jazzed to be bringing onto the show today best-selling author of Sweet Bitter, Stephanie Danler, to talk about what she's...
Oh, wow. Pump that in.
Yeah. There's sound effects on our show.
That's when we're doing something right, I think it's when our engineer is hitting the sound effect button, like the quiet storm.
That's actually the studio audience. You didn't see them?
Oh, sorry. Can't reveal that on the internet.
They're eating their pizza.
We're really excited to bring on Stephanie to talk a little bit about Sweet Bitter becoming a TV show, but also we've been fans of her writing, but also her literary picks on Instagram. We've developed a post-Food Book Fair 2016 where she spoke mostly internet friendship of comparing different reads. So we'll talk to her in a little bit about our mutual love of Renata Adler and Norman Rush and other good stuff and what it's like to try to fit in reading around working around a TV schedule. But first, Amanda, what are you reading or watching or listening to?
Yes, I will get to that shortly, but it really is just so exciting to have you on the show, Stephanie, because you are the embodiment of recommended reading. If you don't follow Stephanie on Instagram, you need to. She photographs books, talks about them, and what she's reading. And
it is true.
We're fangirling.
It is my life philosophy, that whole hashtag recommended reading. I was made for this.
Amazing. Yeah. We're so happy you're here. We'll definitely get to some reading since Stephanie is here, but I'll just share something quickly that I've been watching and enjoying, which is the HBO two-part documentary on Rolling Stone. It's really well done. It has kept me interested enough to watch it from usually around like 10:30 to 11:15, which is pretty much the time when I fall asleep. So I'm almost done with part one. And the amount of archival footage that they have in this documentary is pretty amazing. And also the people that they're able to interview. I did not know that Annie Leibovitz was one of the original Rolling Stone photographers and really helped craft the look of Rolling Stone from day one, or the very early days with Jan Wenner, the publisher and creator, really, and editor-in-chief. One fascinating part that I was watching last night was where Annie and Jan like look at old photos that they've published or some that they didn't and talk about why they included that, why they didn't, what else was going on at that time. Mm-hmm. Another writer that contributed a lot to early Rolling Stone was Hunter S. Thompson. And, you know, he was definitely a character. I think everyone can agree on that. And he went on record saying that Rolling Stone really allowed him the creative freedom to do the kind of writing that he wanted to do. And he was really thankful for that. But I think, you know, what comes with someone who has, you know, just maybe so much going on in their head or who has a different way of focusing than we, you know, think about today, there were definitely hurdles. There was one part where Jan describes that Hunter S. Thompson had a huge deadline. He was writing a story, but no one could find him pre-iPhone. No, no location device on or anything, and finding him. And so they had to show up like at his place and just knock and knock and knock until he came over. And not only were they just trying to find him, they came over with like typewriter paper, food, drinks, and they're like, "We're not leaving until you file your story."
That's pretty sweet. That's a welcoming committee.
Definitely.
I hope my editors are listening. You will not be able to find me unless you bring wine.
This is like how you get me out of the house. Anyway. I think Hunter S. Thompson preferred mescaline, but
you can bring that too.
I think they had to. I don't know if drugs. They brought drugs too, but
I mean, when I was a baby journalist once and young, like, and all my friends who were teenagers who saw Almost Famous and like aspired to become writers because we were like, whoa, you can be a writer and make money this way and it's really glamorous.
That was all like that era of
Rolling Stone and Fear and Loathing and all this stuff that then turned out not to be true in the aughts.
But Cameron Crowe is the real life character.
Yeah, Cameron Crowe is a real person.
In Almost Famous. And Ben Fogg Torres is a real person.
Yeah.
And this, yes, they're all real.
I was always really hype on Ben Fogg Torres because I was like, yes, he's Asian.
Okay, I'll give you that.
You know, totally. Like, we didn't have a lot of like cool Asian dudes.
Anyway.
In mainstream media.
Well,
that wasn't mainstream at the time, but it was like cool media. Anyway.
Recommend the documentary if, you know, the weekend's coming up or you have time over Thanksgiving, definitely check it out.
It's on HBO?
It is on HBO. Okay. It's a two-parter.
Cool. You're going to have to share your password. You're just going to have to tell me one day over the show because we go over this every other week. I don't know about that.
What are you reading, Kim, or watching or listening to?
I've been trying to do some sort of apartment clean, and what ends up happening is I reorganize the books and then I like sit down and then I read them and then like nothing gets organized. But I've been rereading The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde by Junot Diaz. After recommending it to a friend who had not read it before, and Stephanie earlier was saying that's the one book that it seems like everyone loves and has read. Mm-hmm. But it's really worth reading or rereading. When it came out 10 years ago, almost over 10 years ago at this point, Diaz's use of footnotes and his unapologetic, at the time, use of Spanish, Dominican Spanish slang, and how he talked about it, saying, you know, listen, I'll pick up any other book, and sometimes I have to look things up in a dictionary. Like, why can't you do the same in reading my novel? That really moved me as a young person and someone who loved books and read a lot of writers writing about diasporic and immigrant experiences. And it's also really funny and, like, dark and, like, fucked up and beautiful.
Oh yeah, Stephanie, we can say fuck on this show.
Fantastic.
Just in case you need to ask.
You know, those sentences in The Brief Wondrous Life are so special because of the high-low blend.
Yeah.
Because of the like perfectly crafted metaphor and the lyricism mixed with the dirty words and the curse words and the slang. And it's like he invented his own language. It still is a benchmark for that. Even just when you read a short story of his, I'm like, who else is writing like this?
It's also not just the specific, you know, the Dominicanness, the certain narrators that he uses and their machismo mixed with like insecurity and sensitivity, but the sheer nerdery of the sci-fi geekdom and vocabulary he uses in there. That's a whole language I don't understand. Like the amazing thing about, and I regret that I left it in the green room now, but the epigraph to the book, there's an extract of a poem by Derek Walcott, but then there's also a quote from a sci-fi comic book.
High low. Brilliant.
Yeah. So Stephanie, are you ready to share your recommended reading with us?
Oh my God.
Here we go.
It's here that we've been waiting for this moment for so long.
You guys, when I remembered that I was coming on, I started to make a list and then it like morphed into like my favorite massage parlor in Chinatown and like what I'm using. I just like started making a recommended list.
Recommended reading and beyond.
With books. Well, when you said what you're listening to and watching, I just started listing things. I am on this 1970s in New York City bender right now, and I think it has to do with living in the world of Sweet Bitter, which was set in 2006, but really thinking about like the ethos that I'm trying to infuse the show with, which is that New York still felt a little wild to me back then. And I it goes in line. I think, you know, the culture as a whole is always looking nostalgically back at the 70s. You have novels like Garth Risk Halberg's City on Fire and Rachel Kushner's Flamethrowers, Molly Prentice Tuesday Nights in 1980. Then you have television shows like The Deuce out right now. But I just read this book called Blue Money by Janet Capron, which is about being a prostitute in the 70s. But it is, and it's thinly veiled memoir, but it's fun. It reads almost like Edie Sedgwick, like hijinks through the city, or like Eve Babbitt's short stories. And she's a prostitute who went into it from a feminist standpoint of it being like a legitimate way to make money and escape the traps of the generation before her. It, of course, spirals out of control, but it was like being blasted from a rocket through a very dark New York City, and it didn't feel moralizing at all. And then right on the heels of that, I read Dancer from the Dance by Andrew Halloran, which is this incredibly perfect portrait of gay life in New York City in the 70s. And I feel like it coming, the book ends in like 76. And so it's right before the AIDS crisis. And it's very rare that we read like a gay love story now that doesn't put AIDS into the picture. But this was like the free for all, the like decadent promiscuity and this sort of ascendancy of gay culture, especially in the cities. It was like they were running fashion and they had incredible jobs. And it felt like the tide had really turned right before things came crashing down. So it's just incredibly poignant, and the sentences are bananas.
I love the title too.
It's from a Yeats poem.
Yeah.
So there, yes, it's a great title.
Maybe one day after you're done filming, we can come over and do a book swap.
I don't give away my books.
Oh, darn.
Oh, that's a good question, because we have different people on. Do you lend books or just...
I don't. Not I'll buy you a book if I want you to read it that badly. I don't. Too many special books.
I think I'm going to adopt that policy. I have like 4 books out right now. And I
when I give, I know they're gone forever.
Yeah.
But that's sort of part of it. And sometimes things come to me and then I give them to somebody else and hope the lender doesn't mind.
That's a healthier mindset.
It's like a Marie Kondo practice about books. But there are things that I hold on to.
I write in all of them, and I bookmark, and they have some. I do so much rereading. I feel like they still have something to tell me afterwards, and the thought of not having that marked copy panics me deeply.
Well, I definitely do mark up and then hold on to certain books, one of them being Mating, which I saw you posted about. And we had emailed how we first started this conversation about having you on the show. It was like, hey, what dates are you available? You said you were back working on the TV version of Sweet Bitter. And then I said, P.S., have you read Mating? And then it's a book by Norman Rush. I think it is one of the only successful examples of a male author writing a female voice as successful as he does it. It's about a wayward anthropologist in Botswana in the 1970s or early 80s.
Early 80s.
She falls in love and then pursues a sort of development guru across the desert. It sounds really dry, but it's
no, I would call crazy. Him like a cult, cult figure or a philosopher almost.
Where are you in Mating?
I'm in the middle of it. That book, it made me remember what great novels can do. The voice sucks you in immediately. The authenticity of it's never broken, and it's an entire world. And it kind of stretches the boundaries of realism sometimes, as far as some maneuvers feel very novelistic, but in the same way that Donna Tartt does that and mm-hmm. you buy it completely, Norman Rush does it. Mm-hmm. And I love that this female narrator is so self-aware and not charming. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? She's extremely smart, but she has all these edges mm-hmm. and she's not nice. Like, her stream of consciousness thoughts about people are very critical. I love unlikable narrators, and I hate the term unlikable, but I don't know how else to categorize it, where she just feels very authentic, unapologetically herself.
Like a real person.
Yeah, you could say like a real person as opposed to a fairy tale.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the things, and Amanda and I have discussed this, that have appealed to us about the protagonist of your book, Sweet Bitter, is how there's like a lot of unlikableness, mm-hmm. though there's a lot of charm and likableness. And seeing the story unfold in her voice, but then learning more about her through other people, though that only comes later and sort of few and far between, sort of in the same way that the unnamed narrator and mating sort of comes across, I think.
This person
builds their world. They're like, this is the world around me, and the reader, you sort of get sucked into that. And then it's like hearing things about someone that you're getting to know, and you're like, oh, wait, I didn't know this was something, or like, this was this person's name, or like all this stuff.
Right, yeah. Which is the way that information actually unfolds. You don't get a paragraph of exposition before you sit down to dinner with someone. Yeah. And it takes years to reach people's true character, which is why the book, Sweet Bitter, it spanned over a year, but she doesn't learn that much. She doesn't learn answers to life's big questions.
Yeah.
Because I never buy that. That's when I drop a novel and I'm like, I'm reading make-believe.
Yeah. Can we just back up a tiny bit and let our audience and listeners know a little bit more about your story, how you came to write Sweet Bitter, how just you were working in the restaurant business in New York, you went back to school, Sweet Bitter. Talk to us a little bit about how, like, did you always have the idea for Sweet Bitter, and just how you actually made it happen?
Yeah, that will take up the rest of your radio show.
I would like to start by pointing out that we have two Union Square Hospitality Group alumni in here, so there might be some other
bonding. Won't nerd out too much, but I don't know if even I have heard you speak about that. And I know a lot of our listeners are aspiring writers and maybe, you know, wanting to just learn a little bit more about
the
your
process.
Time in New York and how that informed you. And the very, very short version.
Yep,
and then
I got
we'll
you.
Get into some other things.
I'm well trained for this. So I moved to New York to become a writer. I had gone to undergrad and majored in creative writing. And when I got here, I got a job in restaurants because that's what I knew. I'd been working in them since I was 15 years old. And I thought, I will do this for a little bit and I'll sell my novel.
Okay,
right?
So you knew this plan from day one.
I'm 22 years old. That novel is actually like not that bad, but terrible.
Oh, that was a different. Okay.
Yeah, that was a different book. I had written it in college.
Wow. Okay.
And as soon as I was hired at Union Square Cafe, my world like tilted, the axis tilted, and I became obsessed with food and wine and hospitality. And that began a 9-year journey in New York hospitality. And I went to wine school and I helped open a wine store. And I went back and managed beverage programs and I opened two restaurants. And I was approaching my 30th birthday. And there were a lot of like big life decisions coming up. And I thought, if I do not write this book right now, I will never write it. And the book I was thinking of was Sweet Bitter and had been in my mind probably, this was in 2012. I went back to school probably for 2 years. I'd been sketching things, trying to capture the side of restaurants that I wasn't seeing in the mainstream media. The opposite of the Anthony Bourdain top chef, male-driven, testosterone-filled kitchen view of that world. I was really aiming for something much more delicate and sensual and feminine. And it's not an accident that my book is really about the relationship between two women and their senses and the development of a sensory palette. And so I went back to school, which I needed to do. I don't know that everyone needs to do it, but I'd been in restaurants for so long. I didn't have a community. I didn't really remember how to write. And then I did nothing else for 2 years and finished the first draft of Sweet Bitter while in school and waiting tables at Bouvette, and which is an incredible restaurant in the West Village. And so that's all great. You finish your master's program, you're in a shit ton of debt, and you have a manuscript, and you're like, oh, wait, what did I do? Did I even write a book? Like, what was that huge leap about? But I found an agent, and we were about to send it out, and I was waiting on a customer, and I remembered that he was an editor. And I looked at him, and I was like, Peter, you're an editor, right? And he was like, yeah, I've worked at Penguin Random House for blah, 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 many years. And I was like, that's so funny because I'm a writer. And he was like panic stricken.
Right.
You know, he offered to let me send him the manuscript, and I sent it. And 2 days later, he wrote me, and he was blown away. And we took 11 meetings with publishers for Sweet Bitter, and Knopf was our seventh, and he presented me with a bottle of Premier Cru Burgundy for me to open, and he said, nothing bad is going to happen with this book.
Wait, when was the wine? When was the wine? When did he give you the wine?
At the beginning of our Knopf meeting.
Uh-huh.
So I'd been going on meetings all week, and he like presented it to me, and he was like, no matter what, just open this when you sell this book. And that is how that happened.
Amazing. Fast forward a couple of years.
Jesus.
Obviously. Mm-hmm.
Years now.
Literally.
Huge success. And we definitely want to get into talking a little bit about the book, because I think we have questions that we've never asked you, though you've so kindly participated in Food Book Fair before. Mm-hmm. We got to ask a lot of questions then. Also, in the short version, did you ever in your wildest dreams think that it would be a television show, get made into a television show? Was it something you hoped for? Was it something?
I didn't really have a feeling about it. You know, okay. I think that every book, if you guys have friends that are writers, gets optioned usually. Mm-hmm. Like, people in Hollywood are starving for content. No offense, but they are. They pretty much pick up everything. So I thought that it would be optioned and it would die a slow death in some like office somewhere, because nothing gets made. It's like so impossible. So yes, never in my wildest dreams did I think that like 2 years after the book came out, the show would be premiering. That makes no sense to me. I'm very dazed, actually. Can you guys tell? I'm just like, what the fuck happened?
Well, we've also been talking that based on your work schedule, it wouldn't be surprising that you're a little dazed right now.
That is true. Yeah. When they, no one explains the schedule to you. It's like if I work a 12-hour day, it's a miracle.
Yeah. Tell us about TV.
Oh my God. When you,
I mean, it sounds like you're in the Navy Yard 16 hours a day.
So you're,
the crew has built an entire restaurant facsimile.
You guys, this restaurant is a fucking masterpiece. Set designers are going to study it. I'm not bragging. I had nothing to do with it. I'm just telling you, it is a fully functioning restaurant. Our stoves in the kitchen are from 2006. They have flames. All of our background extras have been trained to sear their steaks, chop their herbs. Like, they went to 2 weeks of boot camp at ICE, the Culinary Education Center. And I'm working with two people that I worked with at Union Square Cafe, former back waiter and the former sous chef I brought on as consultants.
Mm-hmm.
And so we drive the production people crazy because there are two kinds of reality. There's restaurant reality and there's television reality. And the producers in general are true to television reality. But I'm like, if this has to be perfectly authentic.
So you are the executive producer of Sweet Bitter, the Starz television show.
Yeah.
And that is something you've never done before.
No, come on. But I've managed restaurants. Not that, not dissimilar at all. No, my team, I'm with Plan B and my showrunner, Stu Zickerman. They really supported me in branching out. I can think of a dozen people I could have gone with that would have tried to put me in a box or told me that I didn't have the experience, but they have like bolstered me and supported me and pushed me forward. So I'm doing all of it.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I'm here. I'm in it. We're in the middle of it. We're in the middle of shooting. I just ran away from the shift drink scene.
Thank you for escaping shift drink in the middle of the day to join us on the radio.
I know. There's no time inside the stages.
Tell us about the shift drink scene.
Well, shift drinks are fascinating. First of all,
is there a difference between restaurant reality and TV reality for shift drink?
No, this scene is so true to the book, to the scene that I wrote, because I think that shift drinks, your first time you come into the restaurant late at night and you see your coworkers changed into their real clothes and you see their skin and their hair down and they're taking off their mask in a way. I think it's so sensual. And back then, we used to, after Union Square Cafe would shut down, and many restaurants I worked at, but everyone starts smoking and rolling their own cigarettes, and you're finishing off kind of the by-the-glass wine, and it's this after-hours club that's just yours. It's just your private space to relax together. It's the most precious time, and I think that's why people, that's where the camaraderie comes from. It's a shame to see it gone now. Because it was such a pivotal bonding moment. But yeah, people don't do it anymore.
Yeah, it was also...
What was it like at... Amanda worked at Gramercy Tavern for a long time.
Well, for me, it was a way to get to taste more wine. Mm-hmm. Also, beers that I had never heard of before. I was pretty young when I was in the restaurants, and also like the whole idea of craft beer was kind of just starting, and so I remember just trying to taste as much, you know, as I could and still learn a little bit, but also have that kind of deep breath out when you got to punch in your drink and it was waiting at the bar. And I was a maitre d', so I would go, everyone had their own kind of zones in a way for where they would enjoy their shift drinks. So
yeah, we did that.
A lot of times the servers would be in the private dining room if the party had already finished and they were finishing their side work, and they would bring their shift drink in there as the night was winding down. The maitre d's and the hosts and the reservationists would go downstairs to kind of our office. And also that was where some of the chefs were and cooks were already coming down and putting some of their whatever proteins they hadn't used for the night or any of their mise en place, or getting, you know, bringing it all back downstairs to the walk-in or some of the other refrigerators. So we each had our own zones. But I was super thankful because I got to really, and Gramercy, or I got to really try a lot. Gramercy was very generous in that if it was, you know, something that was open and something that we were serving to a guest, really, I mean, with a couple of exceptions, we could try it.
Yep.
And that was really so valuable.
I mean, that's how you build an incredible staff, is through education. And I think that is, besides the camaraderie, which is like the emotional core, I think like the education is what you lose when you stop letting your staff taste your wines in a somewhat controlled environment. Listen, the shift drink that we're filming right now is like a Bacchanal. Right. It wasn't like that every night. I'm like, more cigarettes, more wine, more glassware. That's television reality, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we have to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about even maybe more shift drinks or...
Great.
Any number of topics.
Yeah, of course.
With Sweet Bitter and Sweet Bitter. The show is called Just Sweet Bitter. That's it. Okay.
Not Just Sweet Bitter.
Right, Just.
But the show is called Sweet Bitter.
Not Just, but the show is called Sweet Bitter. There's nothing before or after it.
Sweet Bitter on stars, guys.
Sweet Bitter on stars.
Jesus Christ, that is giving me a panic attack.
May 2018.
May 6th, man.
May 6, 2018. We'll talk about that and more and not create more agita, but hopefully excitement and pleasure with Stephanie Dandler after this break.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Okay, I guess we're on the, don't want to talk about that on the radio.
We are back. This is Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair. We're joined in the studio by Stephanie Dandler, author of Sweet Bitter and executive producer of Sweet Bitter on Stars, the TV show.
With a Z, Stars with a Z.
You guys, I can't do anything about that Z. I've tried.
It's on Stars. Set your calendar.
For May 6, 2018. So Stephanie's busy at work on that right now. They're filming in Brooklyn.
Woohoo!
Mm-hmm. But that's why she's back in New York. But otherwise, she's been in LA for a little bit now.
That is true.
And we'll get more into the TV show. But this is one of the things that we talked about before we came in here. You said you started making a list of recommended reading and stuff you were reading. And then it sort of spiraled into a list of things you want to do when you get back home and you're not working all the time on the set. Your favorite massage parlor in Chinatown.
Yeah.
Does every recommended media list sort of turn into like a recommended things or pleasure enjoyment list?
That's the culture, right? I when I was making this list, I was like, this is essentially what Instagram is, which is like lifestyle recommendations. Mm. Well, some people's Instagram. But we do definitely live in a moment where like recommended massage parlors and recommended vintage stores and recommended like low-key, the like secret network versus the mainstream go here, go here, go here. So I think that's just my default. I also like, as I was saying, I'm getting these cheap Chinatown massages once a week right now. It's like how I'm coping with whatever schedule I'm on. So I guess I was just excited to talk about that instead of books.
What's your favorite Chinatown massage parlor?
So it's Fission Herb Center, you guys. I like could write such a glowing testimonial, but I will just say they don't use lotion. It's all acupressure, and it's $45, and you don't come out of there all like greasy smelling like cheap Jergens, which is a different kind of massage, and I'm fine with that too. But they're all trained, and I've gotten acupuncture there before for years. It was like a restaurant industry place that everyone went. And like acupuncture by real doctors for like, you know, $40. You can't beat that. I miss it. I crave it when I'm in LA. So yeah, my treat right now.
Fission Herb Center. Yeah.
Instead of reading, I'm getting massaged. I don't know, guys. I'm changing.
Is there any other recommendations that go along with like
a couple of hours that you would get to spend? Like, do you stop off and get a snack?
Oh, my
God. Like, is it like a full picture?
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the routine?
35 mm for Korean beauty products, for sheet masks and serums. And okay. It's this magic little store above a place where they hang the roasted ducks up. And
it's on the second floor.
It's on like Canal and Mott, and it's always packed with girls with porcelain skin. Mm. And I come in there and I'm like, just tell me what to buy. I'm very into Korean 10-step skincare right now. It's like pretty much all I can do for self. Like self-care is all I can do to balance this.
It's incredible the number of steps amount of time.
Did you mention it in your Grub Street diet?
Maybe
that you were doing a mask with your sister.
Yeah, I do. But like, I do masks like 4 times a week. I'm a psychopath, so I'm always going to the fucking Korean beauty store, getting my massage, and then eating at Pho Grand, where I've been going for a million years.
Okay,
That's kind of where that ends.
What's your order at Pho Grand?
Oh my God, just the regular with the tendons, just like, and then extra like jalapenos inside the soup. I'm a big fan. Very spicy.
I used to go to Pho Bang.
Me too.
And then I started going to Kong Lee. And I only recently, I was a pescatarian for many, many years and recently in making the switch back. So I have yet to have beef pho.
Oh my
since
God.
I've made my return. So.
The broth is a tonic. It will save your life. Yeah. I truly
like Kong Lee a lot.
Yeah, I'll try it. I'm like out the game, you guys. I don't know about the like real places to eat in New York. Like Pho Grand was my spot back in 2012.
Well, that's so important too, to have those places. And sometimes you realize they're not actually that good.
I know, totally. Yeah, no, I'm like, Roberta's is still new, right? Like, yeah. I don't know. I'm stuck.
Yeah. My one mini version of that I've done from time to time. It doesn't have to do with massage and it doesn't have to do with pho, but it's like my two-parter neighborhood hang, which is going to the movie theater. Of course, the name is escaping me. Kim, help me. The one on Ludlow
that I love.
Metrograph. Yeah. And then going to Scars for pizza.
That's
my one-two punch lately.
Yeah. That neighborhood is so fun. You can get a massage after your movie.
That I could recommend.
It's right over there.
I think I'm gonna achieve a three-parter. It's gotta be like massage, the pizza, movie, maybe over Thanksgiving weekend.
That neighborhood, like that Chinatown Lower East Side neighborhood, is one of those, it cannot be replicated. And so I do think it's what I miss the most. Like I don't miss Brooklyn when I'm in LA. I miss New York's Chinatown. The LA one just isn't cutting it.
Yeah. I am meeting. So we are helping support a 2-night Palestinian pop-up, last night at Dimes and tonight at Lolito. We had the chefs, Amani Ahmad and Aura Wise on our show last week to talk about it and preview it. And Amanda and I are both heading down to Lolita later, but I'm meeting some folks beforehand, somewhere between Dimes and Lolita down there. And they're like, where do you want to meet? And I am so like, I really want to give a good recommendation. I want to make sure it's a like nice place. We can sit, we can hang.
What about recommending a massage prior to
it might be harder to have a conversation while getting massage.
Is it a bar you're looking for?
No, not necessarily, but someplace that has drinks.
What about Eastwood?
Too far east.
I love Forget Me Not, which is far east.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But
yeah.
It's a touch divey, but
yeah.
I will take meetings there. Forget Me Not or 169, kind of in that little triangle. 169.
I think part of it is like when someone asks me for a recommendation, I always feel so I want to make sure it's good. I want to make sure it's better than like a Yelp list or like.
Totally. Well, that's your brand. You guys do a recommendation show.
But it's also, we do a recommendation show. This is true. But it's always like, I remember 10 years ago, a friend was like, you should start a text message business where you just tell people where to go. But like in your words, in a text message. And now a colleague in the food world has introduced me to someone else about recommendations for Oaxaca, Mexico, which I love and have spent some time in. And I'm like stalled on, I keep marking this email as unread because I'm like, I don't have time for this, but I also really want to like be real and like give good recommendations and have this person have a great time.
I take it really seriously too. My Mexico City list, it's like you can't just, people think when they're like, oh, I'm going to Barcelona, like where do you like to go, that it takes you 2 seconds, but no, you have to be
I rewrite
thorough.
Mine every time.
I know, me too. I delete things that are not cutting it anymore. This is like psychopathic behavior. I just want
this conversation is inspiring me to actually make my list for New York as someone who grew up here, and
I don't have
always asking
list.
Me like, where should I go, what should I do, who should cut my hair, who should this, and I think I'm just gonna, again, over Thanksgiving weekend when I have some downtime, I got a
weekend
like,
project,
because it was also inspired by one other thing which I have talked about on this show many times, which is The Cut, the digital version of the fashion vertical of New York Magazine, mm-hmm. which I think has some of the most incredible content mm-hmm. out there.
Is the and strategist part of The Cut?
Oh, yeah.
I'm obsessed with the strategist.
Oh, my gosh. I bought so many things from the strategist. It's so embarrassing. I cannot.
Me too.
The snail patch underneath.
Well, you can get those at 35mm.
Oh, my gosh. It's coming. Amazon said it shipped.
I haven't bought it then.
Oh, my gosh. It's so good.
Their pillow that cures neck pain that the strategist told me about changed my fucking life.
It works? Oh,
my gosh. Oh,
do you wear the snail patch and the pillow on at the same time?
Oh, that's like every selfie I send my boyfriend from New York. I'm like, just doing me right now in my like orthopedic pillow. Orthopedic's the wrong word. But in my like old lady pillow and my double mask.
Well, there was this, basically, like, I just love how some of the writing is constructed, and it's so real. They're like, everyone kept asking me about what I did for my skin, so I just shared a Google Doc I created, and it's literally on The Cut. It's a link to a Google Doc. It's like, these are the 12 products that I use for my skin. This is where I get them. This is what they do. This is the order. She was just basically like, everyone kept asking me about it, so here it is.
I only use one thing to wash and moisturize.
Oh, what? Don't know, you
not
dare
10
do,
steps.
Don't
I'm like,
you, don't you do a
what
deep
do you
dive?
Use,
every I use. Usually I make a blend of oils, but sometimes I use everyday oil, which used to be, I think, based out in the Hamptons, but moved to North Carolina.
Okay.
But you can get it at Dime's
but
in the market.
But what's the base oil?
It's jojoba, coconut, there's castor oil, there is essence of Palo Santo and sage and sandalwood.
Pretty.
And some
is that
other, lavender.
Is that a cleansing oil? I'm like hijacking
I don't
your
know.
Show.
I don't know.
Your skin looks really good,
guys.
By the way.
It's really low maintenance. I just use a couple things. I don't ever think about
I'll
it.
I'll send you the Google Doc. Amanda did send me a link to the Google Doc. This is a nice overlap, media and food here. She sent me a link, and my iMessage is broken, so it took me like a long time to check it. But Amy Schumer is dating Chris Fisher, according to The Cut.
I don't know who
Chris Fisher
is.
Farmer and chef of Beetlebung Farm, and what's the restaurant? The Obamas love it on Martha's Vineyard?
Yeah. It's
Beach Plum.
That's the name of his restaurant?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I remember Beetlebung Farm. Yeah, basically all I do all day long is send different links to The Cut to different groups of friends. Like one of my teen texts is like all about, sometimes they'll post like amazing content about guys, like Jake Gyllenhaal just wants like this type of nice girl next door or something. And they
and
like,
then the article's like two sentences. I'm like, this is bullshit. I still clicked on it.
And then
fucked up.
Like, breaking news, Amy Schumer and chef Chris Fisher are confirmed to be dating, because there's one grainy photo of them eating dinner together that got published on the
good for him though. Like, yeah. She's a catch.
How else would Amy Schumer and Chris Fisher be hanging out? They must be dating. No. Yeah. I'm just going to put that out there.
Why would they?
We don't know Amy Schumer, but we do actually know Chris Fisher. I hope you're not listening to this, but if you are, you can also like text us and that, you know.
You can just tell us what's happening.
You are, dude. You are winning, totally winning. Well, clearly we have recommendations for a lot of different things, and if The Cut ever wants us to give our recommended reading or other recommendations,
I've
we
written
are,
for them a bunch.
Oh my gosh.
No, I'm into the strategist.
Pitch us.
Yeah. I'll send them your way.
What else are you working on, or what are you looking forward to working on or reading or writing or relaxing in after you're done with the show.
So we're wrapping shooting around Christmas, which seems like years away, but I know it will be here before I know it. I'm really excited about the Chris Krause biography of Kathy Acker.
Oh, yeah.
I started it and I was like, I want to just like luxuriate in this, and now is not the time. And I think that will be my first book when I'm like back on back on the reading wagon. And I'm writing a second book. You know, in June, I was at a residency in Spain and I was in the zone with this book. And I was like, I'm going to have it done before the end of the year. It was already quite late. Still late. Hi, everyone at Knopf. And it has been obliterated. And so I'm excited to go back into writing. But the first step of that for me is reading. And so it will be, I think January will be a lot of reading, a lot of note-taking, hopefully a lot of walking and quiet. I mean, we'll still be editing and blah, 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 million things, but it won't be like this right now.
What's the first thing you're going to do when you touch down in LA now that you live
there?
Oh, my
God. I was just there and it was heaven. Okay. I'm, you know, the first thing, just my special pillow, and like it's my bed. I have this like Tempur-Pedic mattress. I have my weird old lady pillow, these Mateo sheets that I'm obsessed with. The first thing I do every single time is I get into my bed, and I've never been that person. I'm kind of more of a gypsy, but there's something about my setup in LA where it really feels like I want to nest and like burrow into it. The Silver Lake Farmers Market on Saturdays, like if my plane lands at noon and it closes at 2, I go straight there. You guys, the California Farmers Market in the winter is just,
You're making us jealous.
I know, I don't want to say it. It's just really painful. Yeah. I'm sorry to you, both of you.
I experienced my first summer California Farmers Market, but I'm such a citrus junkie
It's the tables of citrus. I die. They're beautiful. You want to make sculptures out of them and just you want to put them on everything and like just have bowls of them all over your house. It's heaven.
Hopefully we'll get there this winter.
Yeah, you guys don't look hopeful.
No, we are.
Amanda's trying to wink at me across the
I heard Food Book Fair might have a West Coast.
Yeah.
We're working on that.
Yeah. We're working on that.
Citrus dreams.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one motivation, but maybe we can hang out and talk about books while we're out there too.
Yes, please. Very much.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time.
I'm sorry, you guys, about all that beauty stuff.
No,
I think that's important. This is like a holistic, you know, interview with our guests.
Yeah.
It has to be not just what you're consuming, but that's also like what
my life
brings
right
you pleasure and enjoyment.
I'm going to reference that Google Doc as soon as this show is over again and
that
see what
great.
I'm missing. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Cannot wait to see the show.
And also for your new book.
Yeah new book and also reread Sweet Bitter.
Oh, good. Thank you so
One
much.
One of my favorites.
I still think, wait, no, I can't.
Kim lent me her copy and I lent it to someone else and I don't know who has it. But if any of my friends are listening to this or do listen and you have my copy, please return it.
Don't lend your books out.
It's hardcover.
Period.
That's going to be it. That'll be like the end of show debate question. Do you lend your books out starting now? Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Stephanie.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Recommended Reading is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.